From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The midterm election is about a week and a half away. Early voting in Maryland began yesterday and runs through next Thursday. We're talking with the two main candidates for governor. This morning, the Democratic candidate, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, joins me live in studio to talk about how a Brown administration would differ from an O'Malley administration. The Republican candidate, businessman Larry Hogan, has agreed to join us next week. Plus, the musical Next to Normal is now up at Center Stage. Tom Hall talks with a cast member and the director about how they keep up with this high-energy play.
There's an incredible kind of force field of energy around it. It's as if everyone in the piece is really searching for a way to get through.
First, the latest news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Today marks the first day in the Islamic calendar year. Happy New Year to everyone marking that occasion. Maryland's election for governor is a week and a half away on November 4th. Next Wednesday, we'll speak with Republican candidate for governor Larry Hogan. But first, right now, we're joined by the Democratic candidate, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Sheila. It's great to be on. And today marks the second day of early voting in Maryland.
It does. And that will go through next Thursday. You have said that your first goal as governor would be to create the most competitive business environment in the nation. What do you think is keeping Maryland from being more competitive than it is now?
Sure. So when you are looking at a business climate, whether in Maryland or any state, there are generally a number of factors that are considered. And why do I know that? How do I know that? Because if you look at, like, for example, CEO Magazine or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or Fortune Magazine or any one of these publications or organizations that rank business climates, they use generally the same metrics or factors or criteria. And they include things like tax liability, things like regulatory and licensing environment, also infrastructure, quality of workforce, cost of doing business, cost of living, cost of energy. So there are a lot of factors that go into that. Now, when you look at Maryland and our business climate, there are some areas in which we are doing very well. For example, when it comes to quality of the workforce, because that's an important criteria when you look at business climate. We rank very high, and I think that's attributable to the fact that we've got great K through 12 education, our schools, we've got affordable and very good colleges and universities. And in fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, when they look at Maryland's small business community, they rank us number one for entrepreneurship and innovation. And I think that speaks to our quality workforce. However, there are other aspects of our business climate where certainly we need to improve. And there's a lot of room for improvement. As I speak to business leaders across the state, one area that comes up regularly is our regulatory environment. So how do we regulate to protect the environment? How do we regulate to protect consumers? How do we regulate to protect the workforce? And the way in which we do it for many businesses, that they say, and I believe that there is merit to it, that we're over-regulating. We're regulating in a way where the compliance to protect the environment, consumers, and the workforce costs the businesses more than perhaps it should. So when Ken Ullman and I say that our first strategic goal of the Brown-Ullman administration will be to position Maryland's business climate to be number one in the nation, we'll be looking at all of the factors. And I believe that when it comes to regulations and licensing, we've got a lot of opportunities to position Maryland to be strong.
And so what will you do?
So what we'll do is we're going to, as the Greater Baltimore Committee sort of articulated two summers ago, not this summer, but the summer before, in their report. They call it a compact with, you know, the public and private sector. You've got to sit down across the table with the private sector and say, okay, let's agree on what our goals are. Okay, we're going to protect consumers, and you are in a particular industry where, you know, you're selling or your activity impacts consumers. So let's agree to protect consumers. And now what we'll say to the business is, how do you do it? How do you do it? What would regulations look like where you could comply with them, they're not overly burdensome, and we can achieve our goals of protecting the consumer? You know, I had a conversation recently with auto dealers, and this may seem like a small example, but, you know, things add up, and they add up to a lot of dollars. Auto dealers provide a lot of the services that the Motor Vehicle Administration used to provide. And you may remember years ago when you'd have to go back and forth three or four times before you could finally drive your vehicle home. Well, no longer is that the case because the dealerships do a lot of the work. But the paperwork requirement at the MVA, as it's described to me by these auto dealerships who are doing well in Maryland, they say it's just burdensome. And if you forget one piece of paper, it sends the whole package back. So the customer that thought they were coming in to pick up their vehicle today, they can't. And that costs everyone money. It may cost the business money. It may cost the customer money, particularly if the customer is buying a commercial vehicle that they're going to use in their business. That's low-hanging fruit. We can fix that without having to change the law or regulations. We can just change our practices. So there's some low-hanging fruit, but there's also going to be some regulatory issues we have to look at that are going to be a lot more, you know, bigger impact than that.
Let me ask you about jobs. The growth in jobs in Maryland last month was almost entirely in government jobs, particularly state government. Private job growth in Maryland seems to have stalled in the last couple of months. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think a lot of that is due, as I'm speaking with business leaders, Maryland, like Virginia, our economies are so intertwined with federal government activity. So not only federal government employment, but federal government procurement. And we have a contract and a federal government contracting community, business community in Maryland, just like in Virginia, that relies on, you know, DOD spending, NASA Goddard spending, and the like. And I think that's why you see both in Maryland and Virginia, when our revenue estimates were written down, about 3 weeks ago, ours was about $400 million revenue write-down in state government. Virginia was looking at a $2.4 billion write-down. So I think a lot of it is due to the uncertainty, the result of federal government shutdowns, federal government sequestration, and the uncertainty of what to expect. But the question is, what about the way ahead, right? So,
what can you do if you're elected?
What can we do? Absolutely. I use the best example, or certainly a good example, what Maryland's doing in terms of its cyber industry. And you remember years ago that the cyber industry kind of grew out of the Department of Defense related activities to protect the national defense from cyber attacks on our huge information data networks. Well, today, the requirement to protect big data and information goes well beyond the federal government. I mean, banks and newspapers and colleges, it seems like every other week you read in the newspaper that they're hit by a cyber attack. So you've got this private sector customer now who needs cyber protection and support. And Maryland's got a number of assets around which we can develop a very strong industry, small businesses, innovative technology, communications type of small businesses that are creating solutions to the cyber challenges that we face. So that's, I think, a good example, because what I'm really trying to describe is we've got to diversify our economy. So that the federal government is not so prominent in our economy.
That's Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown here on Maryland Morning, WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how and why he's running for governor. You want to institute universal voluntary pre-K. How much will it cost and how would you pay for it?
So the universal voluntary pre-K proposal that I've laid out during the course of this campaign and this last legislative session, we've already begun to make incremental progress towards it. This is what we're proposing, that by 2018, by the end of the next term of governor, and if I'm fortunate enough to serve as governor, we will implement this. By the end of 2018, we will extend universal half-day pre-K to all Maryland four-year-olds. We estimate that means about 29,000, 30,000 four-year-olds, give or take. So pre-K would be available just like it is for kindergarten.
And that would cost what?
And that would cost about $140 million. It represents a 2% increase in our education budget. We've laid out a proposal for funding that, and I think it's important on campaigns, you lay out your proposal. And there are some that have questioned it or challenged it, and that's fair enough. But we've laid out a proposal where additional revenues from expanded gaming would be a part of funding that. As we invest in universal pre-K, and one of the reasons why it's so important is because it helps eliminate the achievement gap in education, then the resources that are otherwise being used to address achievement gap, right? Resources for students who are lagging academically
because they don't have money there, and
we'd save money there, and we could reprogram that for pre-K.
But the gambling revenues already are pledged to education. So is this essentially diverting money from grade school kids to pre-K kids?
No, because pre-K is a part of education, and that's why the General Assembly, I think two sessions ago, we worked with the General Assembly to authorize pre-K as part of that education spending. We've got an additional venue coming online, MGM in Prince George's County. So we'll continue to see increased revenues coming from gaming. But what I've said is that because the benefits of pre-K are so widely recognized, you could talk to a college president or a kindergarten teacher, and both of them will tell you that if you want to improve college readiness, if you want to improve workforce preparedness, if you want to eliminate the achievement gap, you've got to make greater investments in quality pre-K. So we will find within our education budget and from revenues from expanded gaming, savings that we're able to achieve, the growth in revenue in state government, even outside of expanded gaming, we will find the resources to make this important investment. And this is what Marylanders want. As I travel around the state, Maryland families say we need to take the next step in improving the quality of education. And it's widely recognized even by families that pre-K is the next step.
WBAL-TV's Jane Miller reported this week about a contractor for the Maryland Health Exchange who did a sloppy or non-existent job of invoicing for services. Many people are skeptical of government's use of taxpayer money. What needs to be changed in how the state government agencies are run so that the kind of thing that happened with the healthcare exchange doesn't happen again?
I think the healthcare exchange demonstrated that our procurement system in Maryland is quite antiquated.
Was it followed in the healthcare
exchange? Oh, it was followed. Yeah, no, the procurement system was followed, but it's an antiquated system. And let me give you an example of how cumbersome and antiquated this, you know, decades-old procurement system is. When you look at the states that did better on the launch of the health exchange, like Connecticut and Kentucky, one of the common denominators is they had just Deloitte Consulting on their team. So Deloitte happened to get it right. We had IBM on our team, and IBM didn't get it right. Deloitte Consulting didn't even bid on Maryland's work. And the feedback that we got during the process is that Maryland's procurement system is too cumbersome, it's too rigid, it's too burdensome to just, you know, meet the requirements of submitting a successful bid. So I think one of the things that we've learned about the Health Benefits Exchange, and it's not limited to the Health Benefits Exchange, but I've seen this when I've presided over the Board of Public Works, is that our procurement system needs to be reformed. I am proposing in my savings plan to reform the procurement system. But that's not something we've scoped out in detail in the campaign trail, but certainly in the first year as we're looking, because it's part of business climate as well, a more responsive government, a more efficient government, we will undergo procurement reform.
Maryland does not require proof of citizenship to allow residents to get a driver's license. It's supposed to be an immigrant-friendly policy. The Baltimore Sun reported last month that the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, may be using immigrants' driving licenses against them. Basically, they reported about a raid in Catonsville where immigrants were stopped and talked to by name, information that apparently came from the Department of Motor Vehicles. As the son of immigrants, what's your reaction?
Well, let me start by saying that in Maryland, you know, it's my understanding that if you cannot prove documentation of citizenship, then your driver's license that is issued is only for driving purposes, and you cannot use that license, for example, to enter as identification to enter a federal building,
right,
to board an airplane.
But the immigrants or the undocumented people who are getting those licenses don't think that they're going to be tracked by having a non-resident driver's license.
Well, look, let me start by saying, and you know, you acknowledge, I mean, I'm a first-generation American, and my family came to this country 6 decades ago, my father out of poverty in Kingston, Jamaica, and he came to America like so many immigrants for the waves and waves, the generations of immigrants that have built and come to and built and made this country strong. He came for a better way of life, but he also wanted to make a contribution to the greatness that is America. And we have a lot of new Americans in our state, some with documentation, some without documentation. I think it's important that we don't create an underclass of residents in Maryland, which would be a great demand on our economy, on government, on society. So let me start by just saying that in terms of enforcing immigration laws and criminal laws, look, as governor, I will have a fundamental responsibility to ensure the safety of our communities. And if you commit a crime, we're going to, the arrest, the prosecution, and the just disposition of that case. But our law enforcement ought to be used for ensuring that we've got safe neighborhoods and we're reducing crime, which we have been doing in Maryland, and not to sort of double as the immigration enforcement entity. We don't have those resources to do it. That's a federal government responsibility.
Let me move on. Just 28% of registered Maryland voters are Republican, 60% are registered Democrats, and yet the polls in your race are much closer than that would indicate. Why do you think that is?
I think that's consistent with what we've seen over the last, 20 plus years. You may remember 1994, Governor Glendening won by, 5,000 votes out of 1.2 million cast.
Is this race going to be that close?
Well, I don't think it'll be that close, no. But you'll also remember, I was just kind of walking you through history. You remember in 2006, Martin O'Malley and I prevailed with 6.8%. Now, if you're a Democrat running for U.S. Senator, the margins have typically been wide. If you're running for U.S. president and you're a Democrat, the margins are wide. But in Maryland, for gubernatorial races, the races are much more competitive and the margins are narrower. So I think it's kind of historical in Maryland. But look, we're running a very competitive race, and the message of building a better Maryland by focusing on family, working families, and middle class values. We talked about the pre-K. We didn't talk about the career technology education, our proposal to invest in, technology ready modern classrooms. These are issues that are important to Marylanders, and they understand that there's only one candidate and one team, the Brown-Ullman team, that's going to deliver that.
And I remind our listeners, we'll be hearing from Larry Hogan next Wednesday. Your attack ads in this race have become an issue in themselves. In one ad focused on Larry Hogan's opposition to the gun control bill the legislature passed this year, there are images of an assault rifle in all kinds of public places, on a leafy street with kids running past, next to a swing set, in a grocery store, in an office. You're basically saying that's what Larry Hogan's Maryland would look like. You have justified negative ads as truth-telling, but doesn't that cross the line into fear-mongering?
No, I think that as I travel around the state, voters want to hear where candidates stand across the board on every issue. And certainly the Firearm Safety Act of 2013, which Mr. Hogan opposed, which would have banned, which does now, this is the law, it bans assault weapons, large magazine, volume magazines. It calls for common sense background checks, including fingerprinting. I mean, Mr. Hogan opposed Senate Bill 281. Our ads highlight that. And the other thing that has come out of this conversation that should not be lost on the listeners is not only do voters now see where he stands on issues, but I really think that the way that he has approached this issue calls into question his trustworthiness. For example, he told the Baltimore Sun in a forum that Senate Bill 281 he opposed because it went too far. And then he said in a debate against me, Senate Bill 281 he opposed because it didn't go far enough. Washington Post did an expose where they interviewed real people that said that they were in conversations with Mr. Hogan, where he said that he would use executive order to roll back as much of the Firearm Safety Act as possible and appoint a superintendent of the police that would do the same. Yet publicly, he says that he would support Senate Bill 281 because it's now the law. It raises legitimate questions about credibility and trustworthiness.
And we have to leave it there. We're flat out of time. I wish we had more time. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, the Democratic governor, the Democratic candidate for governor in the election on November 4th. Early voting, as Governor Brown, Lieutenant Governor Brown pointed out, began yesterday. It will run through next Thursday. We have information on our website about how you can vote now. That's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, the team behind Next to Normal at Center Stage. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
They're the perfect loving family, so adoring, and I love them every day of every week.
It started as a show called Feeling Electric. In 1998, when the playwright and lyricist Brian Yorkey saw a TV news story about electroconvulsive therapy, he suggested it as a topic of a brief musical to his friend and fellow Columbia University student Tom Kitt. They wrote a draft of a musical inspired by the story for a musical theater workshop in New York. 10 years later, it arrived off-Broadway, where it promptly failed. That's usually the end of the story for musicals, but it wasn't for this one, which evolved into a hit show called Next to Normal, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2010, and in 2011, it was nominated for 11 Tony Awards, and it won 3. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. David Schweitzer is an internationally acclaimed director of plays, musicals, and opera who has returned to Center Stage with a new production of Next to Normal. And he's here in the studio with me, along with a member of this engaging and compelling cast, Callie Dooling. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Tom.
So, David, good to see you again. Yeah. Welcome home, because you're a Baltimore guy.
I am a Baltimore, proud Baltimore
native.
That's
it, born and bred. tell us about the plot of this. This is a musical about, of all things, among other things, mental illness.
I know, imagine that, huh? At first you wonder what there is to sing about. But it's really about how this family copes with the fact that their brilliant mom is bipolar, sometimes delusional, wildly erratic in her behavior, and the ups and downs of that and how it affects their own lives. And there's an incredible kind of force field of energy around it. It's as if everyone in the piece is really searching for a way to get through and anchor themselves and deal with this thing as if it's not the end of the world. And so for all the harrowing aspects of it, there's something kind of exhilarating about it that allows music to be made, even around events like her getting the electroshock therapy, which is a hard rock song.
Yeah.
And then there are tender moments where people kind of confess their feelings. You know, Callie plays the daughter, who is a very bright girl. She's a piano virtuoso, and she's headed out onto graduate school to get away from this situation, but she contends with it on a daily basis, and so, you know, and she's trying to deal with whether or not she can trust herself enough to accept a relationship with a new boyfriend. It's a very rich show, and so I found it really exciting to work on, and to me, it's that kind of thing. To me, these musicals are kind of like the contemporary American modern operas.
Yeah, the energy level of this Cali Dueling is really quite extraordinary. I mean, I saw it in previews last week. You guys, it's a wonderful ensemble cast. I guess there's, what, eight of you, something like that?
Six of us.
And you are constantly in motion, and you are constantly singing. It's not your grandmother's musical. It's not South Pacific where, you know, we talk for a while and then sing a song.
Right.
How do you get the groove with the other five cast members and rehearse, you know, the timing and the energy, keeping the energy going? I would imagine that that's a challenge.
Well, it certainly isn't, it's not the easiest show to perform. It's not, you know, one where you can just go backstage and hang out for a little while and get your energy back for the next number. But in a way, it's almost even more compelling because you are in it for the entire time. If you're off stage for a second, usually we're changing clothes. And then come right back on for something else. So the story is just constantly in motion, and each of our little subplots and things going on are just constantly being propelled forward. So in a way, even though it's intense 2.5 hour show for each and every one of us in our own ways, it's really special to be a part of because there isn't that second to like stop and forget what you're, know what I mean? Forget what you're doing. We're just constantly in it and moving forward.
Yeah, we've all done shows with that have their moments of, oh, Lord, is this thing ever going to be over?
There's never a moment like that. And it's really special to be a part of.
Yeah, because here's this woman with bipolar disorder who receives electroshock therapy, and you would really think on its face, you know, this does not a musical make. On the other hand, you know, we've got Jekyll and Hyde. You know, we've got these other stories that seem kind of violent and upsetting, but they do make good musicals. What animates the music in this thing? You write in a program note, you answer or you raise a really interesting question that Yorkie and Kit, the writer and composer, have figured out why it is people have to sing at certain moments. So why is it?
I think it's because they can't express it any other way. They have no alternative. It needs to move up into another level of communication. And so, you know, something that could be a mundane conversation or a confrontation or, you know, emotions wouldn't be revealed in quite that same way without the music. And so what they've done to me, which is marvelous because they were really young guys when they wrote this, was that they have figured out a way to have people sing in these really complex issues, these emotional roller coastery things, and they use a pop rock vocabulary, basically. I mean, a very sensitive one that's a lot more complicated than it seems. The orchestrations have a really beautiful use of strings, cello. We have an amazing cello player with us, you know, but at first glance, and really mostly permeating the charge, the kind of force of the score, is that rock, chordal, guitar-driven, keyboard-driven musical basis. You wouldn't think that level of complexity could be contained within that kind of music.
Yeah, and there's a lovely mix of ballads and big ensemble numbers and hard rock and roll things, and there's some country western influence in there. There's all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm interested, Callie. How did you get this gig? I mean, what did you do for this audition? Because this casting this would be really important, like for any show.
Yeah.
But I mean, what when you read the script or when you got the call, what did you think? Okay, here's how I'm going to get this job.
I had auditioned for the show before, so I'm very familiar with the material, and it's one of my favorite shows. I mean, as with a lot of people, it's just such a fantastic show. So I got a call from my agent if I could come in. It was kind of a last minute thing, and so I didn't honestly have time to prepare, so I just went and did it, and it was kind of great because I just didn't have that second to worry about my regular freak out and panic. So I just went in and had fun. And
so they had you sing some of the songs from the show?
Yeah. Yep, I sang two songs from the show and did some of the scenes that I have with my boyfriend Henry. And in all honesty, my callback wasn't fantastic, and they brought me back in and had me do it again. And it was great. I mean, I feel very grateful that I got the opportunity because I know it certainly there are a lot of very talented girls out there.
Of course, it's a highly competitive business, but you're terrific in the role.
Oh, thank you.
It sounds great, and it's very convincing. And what's fun for me about this, or compelling for me, I guess, one of the aspects is that every character is quite exquisitely chiseled out and defined, and they're all sympathetic. You love every one of them, you know, and that's a good thing. You know, I find it difficult to relate to the bad guys, you know, or the bad women in these shows. What was it about this piece that appealed to you? You really wanted to do this one. You wanted to jump on this train here.
I did. I raised when Kwame was putting his season together. I really raised my hand. I have been close to situations with people like that, and with
dealing with bipolar disorder,
mm-hmm. dealing with mental illness in general, and I just really love the way this show posits that you can hang in and survive it, and maybe grow from that. I mean, it's so far from an easy answer. It is not, you know, as Callie will say, I mean, in the rehearsals, I said, you know, these people, this is tough love.
Yeah.
This is not a sentimental show. But there is a sense that by having these unusual experiences and learning how to roll with these crazy circumstances, they become bigger, better, more able to help other people. It had something really great in that balance for me, and I felt like it was a good thing for me that I could put it across well, that it would still be entertaining, but it wouldn't be too, you know, soft and droopy. Mm-hmm. That would have some punch.
As you met about this and as you began the rehearsal process, did you worry that a subject as sensitive, as difficult as mental illness, bipolar disorder, you know, and for our listeners who have family members or who themselves are grappling with these really difficult challenges, did you worry that because it was in a rock and roll musical, it was going to be thought to be treated flippantly or you know, insensitively?
I don't think so. I think what's so amazing about Next to Normal is that I don't think that there's any person that could sit in the audience and not relate to someone or something that happens in the show. I mean, we go, you know, walking home after the show, you know, talk to an audience member, every single person has a story or resonates in a certain way. And so I think just in knowing the show and knowing that from the New York production and my response when I saw that a couple times, everybody has, you know, just an incredibly honest and strong response to it. Just resonates with everyone.
Also, this has been on your mind as you conceived of this production. Certainly.
Absolutely. And it's also very funny.
Yeah,
I mean, they battle their you know, seemingly insurmountable obstacles with you know, tough humor. And I think a thing that's really important about it is the casting. And I think, you know, Callie is typical of the success of this cast. They have to feel right. They have to feel like they could be these people and yet have the technical skill to sing about it and to put it over in a heightened performative way. And that's not the easiest. You know, that takes a high caliber. So I'm very fortunate with the cast we have there.
It's a good group. David Schweitzer is the director, and Kelly Dooling plays the role of Natalie in Next to Normal at Baltimore's Center Stage. It's there until November 16th. We've got a link to more information about the show on our website. Go to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. And our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, will share her review of Next to Normal on Monday morning right here on Maryland Morning. Well, David, Callie, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And break a leg for the rest of the run.
Thanks,
Tom.
Thank
you so much.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR in Baltimore. We're produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've got production help from Payam Agagasim and Elizabeth Sherwood. Our coffee is provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. Check them out at the farmers markets or on the web at zekescoffee.com. You can find an archive of our show online at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. You can listen live online anytime at wipr.org/listen. And please join us Monday when we'll begin a new series of conversations right here on Maryland Morning about religion and ethics. It's called Living Questions. And we'll kick it off Monday with a discussion with an Islamic scholar, a Jewish scholar, and a Catholic scholar from the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Living Questions begins Monday morning here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Until then, for Sheila and Nathan, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.